and welcome back to another edition of YCT Matters. This is Carol Platt-Levow. And for this edition of YCT Matters, we are so delighted to welcome a special guest, Rabbi Ari Weisenfeld. And Rabbi Weisenfeld is the Associate Director of the Office of State Relations and Director of the Connecticut Office of Agudat Israel of America. And Rabbi Weisenfeld, welcome to YCT Matters.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure to join.
Well, thank you. We're so glad you could be here. And we're delighted that as this is coming out, it's going to be the beginning of Hanukkah. And to learn a little bit more about Hanukkah, what it commemorates, and to just learn and hear from you. But before we get started on that, I just wanted to speak on behalf of Yankee Institute for a moment and to tell you how deeply we and so many people of goodwill I know stand with you, the people of Israel, and people of goodwill throughout the United States who love our Jewish brothers and sisters and stand very, very much in solidarity with you at this difficult time. And you are in our thoughts, in our prayers, and we care very much for you and support you wholeheartedly.
It's very kind of you to say that, and it's very much appreciated. I'll tell you what I know I've said to some others in recent weeks who I've interacted with across the country, is that had we had more friends like you about 75 years ago, more of my family would be around today. So it's very, very much appreciated. I know a lot of people sometimes don't know what to say. It's a hard topic to talk about. But the fact that somebody is willing to express solidarity, to express, their emotions of what they're feeling and try and understand the pain of the community is so appreciated. And we really need more voices like yours out in the public.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Weisenfeld. You know, we can't repeat the past, but we can learn from it and learn from the mistakes of the past and grow better. And that is what all of us should be committed to doing. And again, as I say, how can people best support our Jewish friends?
It's a great question. I think there's a couple of layers to it. Obviously, there's tremendous humanitarian needs. In Israel, a large portion of the country is displaced, both in the north and the south. People, of course, fathers, husbands that have been called up in reserves and are off now fighting for the safety and security of the nation, which means that all the jobs that they were previously working are no longer being done, or there are sometimes people who are retired are trying to fill in, or teenage kids, et cetera. So there's definitely tremendous humanitarian needs. There are wonderful organizations that can quickly be found with a quick Google search that can be contributed towards if that is how somebody would like to contribute. And like I said, there's too many really to start naming. Friends of the IDF would be one to help, lone soldiers. And there are organizations that, the Federation, Jewish Federation of the United States, all the different Federation chapters across the country are having fundraisers for, local communities in Israel. But for people that want, say, not everybody is in a position to contribute financially, your voice is free and your voice matters. And standing up and saying things exactly what you expressed to whatever level of influence you have over your sphere of influence, whether that's just friends and family, if it's a public official, to talking to their constituents or in bodies of government, your voice is free and your voice is powerful. And it's much needed because we are unfortunately feeling very alone, for a large segment of the Jewish community in the aftermath of October 7th, for about 24 hours, there was complete solidarity. And then I remember talking to a friend of mine and saying, I wonder how long it's going to be before this flip-flops quick. And it took about 48 hours, maybe even quicker. And many of the organizations and social organizations and organizations that at least publicly say that they are humanitarian and they are, trying to fight for human rights of people across the world, seem to have forgotten that Jews are people and have been now it's kind of a question of, is it better just to say nothing at all, or is it better to say something 55 days later? I mean, it's insane to think that an organization like, and I don't think it's crazy to put any of them on blast, whether it's the UN or UN, Women's Commission, whatever the official name of it is, to take 2 months to condemn the use of.
Yes, I have spoken out about the UN Commission on Women and the abject failure and the complete hypocrisy of their silence on the use of systematic rape and sexual violence against Israeli women and apparently now some men. And the fact that they remain silent, along with the National Organization for Women, Planned Parenthood, and a number of American organizations that style themselves as women's organizations. There is no organization that can credibly claim to care about women who can be silent about what are obviously appalling acts. And, you know, we could spend an entire podcast talking about what happened in graphic detail. But anyone who cares to become acquainted with the facts, they are documented in photographs and in eyewitness testimony. It is real. And anyone who can both sides an issue like this is obviously either uninformed or not operating with good intent. And I don't want to hear anything from any representative of that organization ever claiming, again, to care about women or represent their interests. They clearly do not, if they can remain silent in the face of such egregious evil.
Absolutely. And it's been very, you know, disheartening to see that firsthand. Obviously, we've been, the community has been screaming about a anti-Jewish bias for years in some of these organizations. And it was shocking to see just the level that they're willing to just put blinders on and ignore, you know, pain and suffering done to the Israeli people. You know, it's one thing, which again is terrible, always terrible. In years past, when terrorist attacks have happened, and never once condemning them, never once talking about, you know, the pain and suffering of individual Israelis whose lives were lost in those terrorist attacks, or having their buildings literally sharing a building and renting space from Hamas, you know, and then putting out, you know, statements decrying the use of, you know, what the Israelis were doing in Gaza and saying it's only targeting, you know, innocent civilians when they are literally like rent mates and sharing a conference room with Hamas terrorists is absolutely insane. But, you know, you kind of say, oh, well, that's just, you know, isolated incidents. You almost want to convince yourself because clearly these are good people trying to do good in the world.
No, but this
after October 7th,
this,
it's
no. Yes, this is a whole different level of depravity when people plan to wreak sexual violence on a population as a weapon of psychological mass terrorization. And it is unacceptable. Those people are absolutely an appalling disgrace, but we know who they are. We see them. We know where they stand and we know why. And it is absolutely disgusting. At any rate, so as we said, we send all thoughts, all our support and our prayers to the good people of Israel as they engage in this truly existential struggle, and our Jewish friends here in the United States of America and across the world. Let's talk about some of what sustains our Jewish friends in times like this. And it is the celebration, in a sense, of what has been known as God's chosen people. And some of these remarkable historic and spiritual markers through the year. And of course, this marks Hanukkah. And we would love for you to share with us a little of what Hanukkah celebrates, what its meaning is, and why it is a source of celebration and spiritual sustenance.
Okay, absolutely. So it's a great question. Hanukkah is, you know, a little bit interesting because most of the Jewish holidays are very internal in the sense that they're celebrated in the home or in the synagogue, and they're not very public facing. Hanukkah is a little bit unique. You know, we light the Hanukkah menorah in the window, and some have the custom to light it actually outside the house. They'll put it like in a little box to protect it from the wind. So it's much more public facing than some of the other holidays. And which is a little bit unique for us, it's usually more private and, you know, much more family and oriented. But Hanukkah is specifically for what we call in Hebrew is Persume Nisa, to talk about the miracle and to, you know, expand upon it and teach others about it. So it's a little bit unique in the Jewish faith in that facet. To give a little bit of background and why it's very much relevant today, perhaps more than ever, is Hanukkah is a story that happened about 2,200 years ago. So we're talking about, I mean, that's a long time ago in, you know, in global history. And every single year for about 2,200 years, every single year, the Jewish people have lit Hanukkah candles without fail. In the late 1930s, early 1940s, there are stories of Jewish inmates in concentration camps in Bergen-Belsen, in Auschwitz, smuggling in wicks, making oil from the kitchen or whatever, and lighting Hanukkah candles, even in those conditions. And I think it says a lot, we'll get into a minute, about what the lessons are. But the basic story is, we're talking about the Syrian Greek Empire that ruled the land of Israel at that time. And the Jewish people were living under that rule. And it really, it was not a nationalist movement of, oh, we need to reclaim the land and have our own self-rule. They were fine living under the Syrian Greek rule. They'd actually previously lived under Babylonian rule and the Ptolemaic empires coming out of Egypt that ruled the land of Israel right before that. But as long as whoever was ruling the land allowed the Jews their religious freedoms and said, okay, you can practice your faith. You know, obviously, I'm sure there was taxation and whatever, and, you know, but as a general rule, we're going to leave you alone. You practice your faith, you do your thing. And they were fine with that. And it wasn't until, you know, the Syrian Greek Empire came in with a very different value set. You know, the Greek Empire, I think, is most known for really emphasizing the ego, the, you know, perfection of man. If you look at the statues they build and what they taught, you know, the gymnasiums, that was really a focus of them. It was very self-indulgent, very decadent, very, you know, human-centric, which might remind you of some cultural movements going on today. And that was a direct clash with Jewish values, which, you know, serve, we have to think about others. We need to think about God. There's a higher calling. There's a higher morality that we answer to. So they couldn't coexist. And the Syrian Greek Empire eventually actually told the Jews, you cannot serve your God in your temple. You know, the first temple that was on the Temple Mount, they put in their own pagan idols in there, which I believe some historians say was an idol to Zeus. But, you know, the point is they said, you no longer can serve and worship your God as you choose. Now it's going to be a deity of our choosing in your temple. And that was the red line, really, as well as they outlawed a few of the commandments. Many people know the Jewish people that are Torah observant have 613 commandments that they follow. And three of them that they were explicitly outlawed were the commandment of keeping Shabbos, Sabbath, you know, Saturday. They outlawed the blessing of the new moon. The Jewish calendar runs on a lunar calendar. So every month we have to look to the new moon to establish that calendar. And especially back then it was done through witnesses. Now it's more of a set calendar with a formula. And the third thing they outlawed was circumcision on you know, young male boys that were newborn boys. And those three things actually have a common denominator because all three, you know, Sabbath, the whole day, Jewish people, they rest. They show that we are not in control of the world. We don't look at the stock market. We don't conduct business. We don't build things. We take one day and we give testimony that God created the world and God runs the world. And that is a direct clash with those Greek values. So that had to go. Setting the lunar calendar is looking out and seeing that there's something beyond yourself. The waning and waxing of the moon, that there are phases to life. And that was complete opposition to Greek culture of human-centric, look to yourself. And finally, circumcision, saying to an entire people and to an entire half of the population, the male half of the population, that self-indulgence is not the most important thing in life. You know, you have something on you that is supposed to be used for a higher purpose and it's supposed to be used with an intent. And that was something that clearly was in a direct clash with a decadent culture of self-indulgence. So that had to go. And there was gruesome penalty for anybody caught violating the commandment, the Greek commandment, not to keep those three mitzvahs, those three commands, three Torah commandments. And that was really what started to lead to the revolt. Of once they tried to shut down the observance of the Jewish faith, is when the revolt started. And where we get the lessons of today is the revolt was not a massive movement initially. It started in one town called Modi'in, and it started with one family called the Hashmonaim family. And it started really with one person, Matzio, and his sons, you know, famous Yehuda HaMakabi. Judah the Maccabee is a more famous figure because that's his son, and kind of carried on the revolt after his father had passed. And it took several years. And it slowly grew. It started with a family, then, you know, to a few hundred, to a few thousand. I think the first battle against the Greek army, I think the Jewish people had about 6,000 soldiers versus, I mean, probably tens of thousands of well-trained war elephants, the whole thing, chariots. And it was, you know, a ragtag group of rebels, if you will, that said, no, but until here, you cross the red line, you're interfering with our faith, and we have no choice left but to push back. We don't want to. Like I said, the Jews had lived under, you know, the Babylonian rule and the Egyptian Ptolemaic rule very peacefully for a long time. But this was a red line that we couldn't tolerate. And it started slow and it gained momentum. And it took, I believe, 3 years, if my Jewish history is correct, before they successfully drove the Greek Empire out of the land of Israel. And they were able to reestablish worshiping our God in the temple on the Temple Mount. And that is what the celebration of Hanukkah is on the 25th day of the month, the Jewish month of Kislev. They went into the temple and they were able to clean out all the pagan idols and be able to rededicate it. And the rededicating ceremony took 8 days, took a week, as well as, this is the more famous part of the story, is the menorah, which was part of this, you know, the daily service in the temple. They didn't have any oil to light it with. And really, they didn't have to light it. If there's no oil around, they don't have to light it. They can wait a week till they get sent the messengers out, go to the, you know, the olive fields, get more pressed oil, bring it back, took a few days, 8 days. But they found one little jar. And they just...
So it isn't sort of a religious imperative that
exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly. It was not religiously necessary to light the menorah. It was not the most religiously important thing to do in that moment. They could have said, all right, we don't have the oil. We'll wait a week. We'll get the oil in a week and, you know, we'll do it next week. But they searched and searched and searched, and they found one jar of oil that still had the seal of the high priest, which in Hebrew is called the Kohen Gadol. And that high priest sealed the oil and said, I guarantee, basically, it was like any other seal, you know, it's putting his, you know, approval on it. This is oil that is fit for the service. It had to be, you know, first pressed oil and ritually pure. And they were able to use that oil to light the menorah. And as this, you know, the famous story goes, the oil jug was only enough for one day, but the lights lasted for 8 days until the new oil could be coming from the countryside. And that took, you know, the 8 days. So that's the more famous part of the story. And the lessons are manyfold there. Number one, it really is. It's very interesting that in Jewish history and in Jewish tradition, we don't emphasize the military battle and the military victory. It's, in fact, if you look through the rabbinic texts and the rabbinic scriptures, it's almost not mentioned. It's very off to the side as a side point. The main point they focus on is that the Jewish people rededicated the temple and rededicated themselves to God, and that they went above and beyond what was required of them. Like we said, it wasn't necessary for them to look for that oil and to use that oil. But because they went above and beyond and said, no, we're going to do this properly. We want to serve God as best we can. So we're going to search every nook and cranny of this temple till we find the jug of oil. And then God responded by saying, so in as a direct, well, you went, you know, above and beyond and exerted yourself to find this oil, and you so want to resume the temple service that he allowed that oil to burn for 8 days. So that's one story, and that's really the main lesson as far as, you know, following the rabbinic text through the ages is almost what we teach our children really is about going above and beyond in your service for God and for others. And the military side, we more non-Jewish secular sources that, you know, I mean, Josephus Flavian is one that's very famous that came a couple hundred years later that wrote about it, as well as other people who studied the Greek Empire and, you know, and the land of Israel at that time. But they're typically not Jewish and definitely not rabbinic sources that talk about the military side of it. The other lesson that really is more famous probably and is also incredibly relevant today is that light in the darkness. Is that, you know, the Jewish people were, it was not necessarily the greatest place. Like I said, they just fought a 3-year-long war. It, you know, it took a lot of effort and a lot of resources. And it wasn't like that everything was just rosy from then on out. They had continued to fight, if I believe, in the next 25 years, I think there was, you know, struggles in the land until they came to a relative period of peace. Then the Romans came in after the Greek Empire, and then the Romans took over the land. And depending on which Roman Caesar was in charge at which minute, you know, conditions in the land of Israel changed drastically from tolerable to religious persecution like we've never seen before. And until it led to the destruction of the first temple about 200 years after the Hanukkah story. So it wasn't, you know, happily ever after in that sense. But it did show that the Jewish people were willing to go above and beyond for the service of God. And it showed that even when things don't look great, that God performed the miracle for us by allowing the oil to burn for 8 days until the new oil came in from the countryside. It shows that no matter how dark or how difficult things get in life, we have faith that, you know, there is that light at the end, that things will get better and that God has not forsaken us, you know, entirely and forever. And that things might look rough now. We have to go through trials and tribulations that we may understand and may not understand, given the history, you know, the context of history. But we still have that faith that it will, you know, that God's watching and God will watch over, you know, and ensure that it works out well for us in the end. And that, I think, really is the lesson, like I said before, about why even in the darkness of the Holocaust, Jews were lighting the Hanukkah candles in Auschwitz. And no matter what persecution in, you know, behind the Iron Curtain of communist Soviet Union, Jews were lighting Hanukkah candles, you know, hiding it in their homes, because it's a lesson that has lasted and kept us going for 2,200 years, that the external circumstances around us don't matter. Are you doing your best to serve God and serve your family? And if the answer is yes, then we have faith it'll work out. And, you know, and I think it's also very interesting that for even Jews that are not as Torah observant, they're not as, you know, religious, almost all of them will light Hanukkah candles. It's something that speaks to them in a way that, you know, other aspects of the Torah commandments don't, which is a very interesting thing to me. And I think it's interesting to talk about from a, you know, that perspective. But it's something that I think that because it calls to everyone. It calls to everyone that message of, you know, it's dark, it's winter, we're about to go into the next 2-3 months of winter, but spring is coming. And, you know, it's really is that message of, are you doing everything you can right now in the moment to serve God and serve your people?
So, Rabbi, so there are eight days of Hanukkah, correct?
Yes.
So is Does the ceremony of lighting the menorah, does that differ in any way, or is it the same ritual every evening?
So
and are there
every
ceremonial meals that go with this, or is it really centered on the lighting of the menorah?
That's a great question. To answer, first and second, the custom has developed that every single night we add another candle. So on the first night we light one, second night two, and then three, all the way up to eight. It is actually interesting because that wasn't, entirely clear initially. There were some rabbinic disputes about how to light. Should you start with eight, go down to one? Do you just light one every night? But overall, I think 99.999% of people today will light one candle first night, going up until eight on the eighth night. And that's viewed as the best way to perform this mitzvah, this commandment. And as far as festivities, it is a festive time. It is a time, like I said, because it's a time that at that time, 2,200 years ago, they were able to rededicate the temple to God. So we still kind of commemorate that today with the festivities of recalling the miracle, of recalling, the service to God at the time. So it's not a commandment, the way we have a Passover Seder, which is an integral part of performing the commandment, or other holidays where having a meal is an integral part of having it, of observing the commandment.
Right.
But it is, I would say, definitely part of the tradition. Almost everyone, maybe not every night, but we call it Hanukkah parties. The family gets together, they'll come and celebrate, exchange gifts, have a meal, and, have a good time with the family.
So tell us where the dreidel comes in.
The dreidel is a fascinating, fascinating thing. So the way the tradition goes is that because at that time, like you said, there was religious persecution, and there was, anybody caught observing certain commandments be put to death or horribly tortured. One of those was studying the Torah, that they didn't want anybody, said, let's stick to philosophy, mathematics, whatever was important to the Greek culture at the time.
Right.
But learning and studying the Torah, they didn't view as important. And also they recognized that it was a lifeblood for the Jewish people. And if you can cut the Jewish people off from the Torah, then they may, disappear.
Right.
So that was a capital offense. So one of the things they would, what they do, as the story goes, is they would hide in caves or wherever they were hiding to study. And if a group of soldiers or an informant burst in, they heard them coming, they put away the books, the holy books, take out a dreidel and say, no, we're just playing gambling. We're gambling. We got coins. We have this, we're betting on which side it's going to fall on. It was a diversion tactic. But
and
the
that's
more
where the chocolate coins come from.
That's where the chocolate coins come from. The more interesting thing, though, to me is that probably the two times in the Jewish calendar that we're spinning things is the dreidel on Hanukkah, which you spin like a top. So you spin it from the top and then it spins around. And there's something called a grogger or a noisemaker. I'm not sure if there's a good English word for it, on the holiday of Purim, which is, later in the year.
Yes.
And that's interesting because that's spun from the bottom. You hold it by a handle and you spin it. And as it goes around the handle, there's usually some kind of mechanism that clacks or it has beads inside or something. It'll make noise as you spin it around. And it's very interesting that we spin the Hanukkah dreidel from the top and the Purim grogger from the bottom, because it really commemorates how the miracles were performed. The Hanukkah miracle was above and beyond supernatural. There's nothing natural about oil burning for 8 days. There's nothing natural about an army of 6,000 people taking on the mightiest empire in the world at that time. There's nothing natural. Nobody living through it would view it as natural. It was clearly being spun from the top. It was being controlled by God. It was supernatural. It was spun from the top. The Purim story, which maybe we'll get that podcast in a few months, but that story, of course, is the story of the Jews living in Persia, a little while later. And the story of Haman, who tried to eradicate the Jewish people. If you read through, and it's the book of Esther, for those who want to, look it up in English.
If you have a daughter and you want her to learn it, when I was a little girl, there's this old book named Behold Your Queen by Gladys Malvern. I stumbled across it in our school library, loved it. Now know the story. I had no idea. I was like, and that's the book of Esther when I stumbled on it in the Bible. Yep.
However you choose to learn about it, whether it's through there or the original text in Megillas Esther,
which obviously
Esther,
one obviously
might be
recommends
more
the Bible over but
or a Wikipedia entry,
children,
we're not picking.
Yep, for children, not a bad thing. Okay.
So as you read through the story, there's a couple things that'll jump out at you. Number one, the name of God is not mentioned, which is very unusual for a literal book of the Bible. It is part of the Bible. It is has viewed with the same holiness as the Bible. And the name of God is not mentioned. And if you read through the story, it seems like a series of events. As a child, I love reading a series of unfortunate events, but this is a series of starting off unfortunate and ending up very fortunate in how the story plays out. Because someone living through there may have just not seen the hand of God. It may have been, well, this happened, which caused this, which caused this, which caused this, which almost annihilated us. But then this happened, and that happened, and we were saved. It almost can be viewed as a series of coincidences. So the perm story seems like it was controlled from below. So we hold the grogger, which we hold it by the handle from below, and the top is spinning. And but the Hanukkah story is beyond supernatural. Nobody can think that it was just a series of coincidences. It was clearly a hand of God at play. So we spin the dreidel, which demonstrates that it was controlled and, you know, from the top. And I think that's the lesson we try to give over to our children as we play dreidel, no matter how intense the games get.
Well, it is wonderful, and it is a reminder to all of us as our Jewish brothers and sisters look for the light in the darkness, especially this year, that all of us can and should be doing the same. And I can't thank you enough, Rabbi Weisenfeld, for taking this time to help us understand exactly what is happening. And we now will have a deeper appreciation when we see the menorah, and we know that that is exactly what is being commemorated, that miracle 2,200 years ago.
2,200 years, and we have not missed a single year since. Every single year, you can go back through history, every single year, no matter what was going on, global events or Jewish events, you know, politics, internal, external, the Jewish people lit the Hanukkah candles. And, you know, God willing, that will continue to be the case moving forward.
May it be ever thus. Thank you for taking this time for us, Rabbi Ari Weisenfeld of the Connecticut Office of Agudath Israel. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. It was much appreciated. Thank you kindly.
Well, we appreciate it as well. And we appreciate you taking your time to join us. And for our Jewish listeners, we wish you every blessing this Hanukkah season. And we look forward to you joining us again on the next edition of YCT Matters.
I'll show you around this place I call home.